Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Phil Elverum Discography Breakdown. I am Alex, and with me, as always...
Hello, it is Jake.
We are here. It's only been 3.5 weeks. long and short of why it took this long is because I was, you know, really depressed. But we're here now, and we're putting it back up, and we'll say we'll have an episode again next week, and hopefully that'll be true.
Yes. I will say that these main album episodes are a little more daunting, I guess, to complete.
Yeah, that is true. And this album especially is very kind of dense and mysterious. And I wasn't really thinking about it much before we went in, but it's kind of like a, it feels important. It feels like big, I guess, in the same way that like the Mount Eerie album does.
Right. And if you haven't, I mean, we'll have it in the title, but we are talking about the album Wind's Poem, just to kind of like lay it out explicitly.
Yeah, I guess I didn't say that.
they can read the title.
Yeah, that's true.
But yeah, I've been pretty excited to talk about this album. Not because it's one of like my top favorite Mount Eerie albums, but I definitely think it's one of his most interesting. And a word I used earlier was confounding, which I think is sort of like a Mount Eerie staple at this point in his discography. A lot of his songs just confound me.
Yeah, I think it's, I don't know, it is extra appropriate here. And for some of the same reasons why it was with the Mount Eerie album too, because everything is kind of big on this album. Like, okay, so it's kind of... Every Phil album talks about nature in some way or not, even like... I don't know, but here it's a little more literal. Like in past albums, like the Glow Part 2 has allusions to nature all over the dang thing, but it's all, they're all kind of metaphors or like allusions to how he was feeling. And here, you know, it's still metaphors a lot of the time, but also kind of literal. Like he is specifically talking about like decay and impermanence and, you know, literally wind and stones, even though the wind and the stones also symbolize something.
It is definitely, it toes the line between metaphor and reality, I guess. And I think this album specifically, or I guess the albums around this time, like Dawn and Lost Wisdom and No Flashlight, and all of these albums to me sort of seem to be tackling these really kind of like basic existential questions. You know, you have all these songs that are just like, who, what, like, why, like maybe they like can't be answered in words, but it's like he's sort of trying to like evoke that just existential feeling, or in the case of this album, like let the natural world speak those truths for you or something.
Yeah, I do think this, I think Wynn's poem marks a distinct shift at the same time, though. Like, I understand why you group it with those albums, and I think that's apt, but it's like, he kind of moves from very personal songs to these sort of, you know, like, theatrical... kind of, I don't even know what to call them, but I don't know, this album is very sort of theatrical. It feels biblical in a way.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it is, I would say, less tied into his personal life, like less tying in these existential feelings to like his own personal feelings, and more of just actually kind of like, I don't know, I guess it is still somewhat personal, but he's, I mean, in in that there's an interview that we were both reading earlier where he talks a lot about like what Wynne's poem means or whatever, and just a lot of stuff about like the destruction and rebirth cycle and like the, you know, feelings of impermanence and life is fleeting, and a lot more kind of I guess they are less intrinsically tied into like his personal life than they were on some of those previous albums.
Yeah. Nothing means nothing. Everything is fleeting.
Right.
Don't get used to it. I love those lines, especially how he like, and this is almost, I guess it can't be tangential because I'm literally talking about the album that this podcast is about. but I don't know. I love the way that like, it is kind of tangential to what we were just talking about. I love the way that he, I don't know, when he says everything is fleeting on Ancient Questions, it feels like a snapback. It's like a, I don't know, like, it's like, it almost sounds like a retort.
Yeah.
You know, he's like, don't get used to it.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of this album is sort of this, it's almost like a network of these kind of nebulous ideas floating around, and it's kind of personally hard for me to construct a narrative around them. It all just sort of evokes this like similar feeling, I guess, like I don't know, like the everything is fleeting impermanence thing. It's not like not in like a, oh no, we're all gonna die way, but just like, I don't know, everything that makes up our perception of reality is just like kind of squashed by these giant eternal elemental forces of nature and destruction, like
yeah.
The wind and the stone, and it's like, I don't know, I've been kind of like all week I've been really reading the lyrics and trying to like pull concrete meaning out of them, and I don't know if it's like necessarily supposed to like work that way. I think that's kind of what I've discovered, like it's very, I guess, like visceral.
Yeah. No, I think that's true. I mean, in that interview we were talking about, which we'll just we'll link in the video description.
Yeah.
So anyone who's interested can read it, because it's very interesting and it is illuminating. But in that interview, Phil kind of talks about the opening track and how it's like a primer. Like, it's not, he thinks of it not as, like, song one, but song zero, almost a table of contents, and kind of, like, says that, like, the lyrics are just all these sort of haphazard ideas, not really organized in any specific way, and he's just, like, kind of introducing you to the themes of the album.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I actually mentioned this in the chat recently, and I don't know if this is intentional or not, but the beginning, like the first 10 seconds of this album, when it's just that 100% loud chaotic noise, does like sound like really strong wind, right?
I think it was definitely intentional that he was like trying to do that. I think he might have talked about that somewhere. But there was this, I don't know, there's this performance you linked me to that I guess we'll also link in the description.
Yeah.
Where he plays that song and he's got two drummers, mm-hmm. and it's clear that is what they are trying to evoke. Just like this enormous, overwhelming sense of like wind. And they're just, you know, kind of going ham on this big gong and cymbals and...
It's great.
It is great. It was also kind of interesting to watch him perform during this era, because, like, I don't know, I've seen Phil live twice now, but both times have been since Crow looked at me, so he's been, like, very much not in this mode, and they're, like, in that video, he almost seems like a credible rock band singer.
Yeah, actually, he looked like a front man of a band.
Yeah.
Which is something that I guess I've never really like seen him in that style of performance before. Because the one time I saw him, it was, you know, just him and an acoustic guitar. And most performances that he has on YouTube or whatever are also sort of just him and a guitar. So it is interesting to see the full kind of like maximalist sound being performed live.
Yeah. No, it's definitely interesting. Also, you go back to like a lot of microphones shows were just him too.
Right.
Just like him, you know, alone with a guitar or like one other person adding one supplemental instrument, you know?
So totally.
It doesn't, I don't think that is necessarily like the most common for him as a performer. I mean, you know, like clearly this era and like Clear Moon, Ocean Roar, and probably Sauna too, but I don't know. I don't think he's done a lot of that in his career.
No, and that actually leads me to a question I was going to ask at some point. How do you feel about Wynn's Poem? I feel like is often sort of touted as his like black metal album.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that categorization or that assessment of the genre of this album?
Kinda yes, but only in the same sense that like the Glow Part 2 is a folk album, you know?
Yeah.
Like that is very much a part of its style and ethos, but it is only one aspect. And like half the songs on this album I would not comfortably refer to as black metal. But you know, like Wynn's Dark Poem, The Hidden Stone, like those tracks are
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I think in maybe it was either that interview that we just referenced or another one that I was reading, he said that he wasn't necessarily trying to make a black metal album, like a quote-unquote black metal album, but just songs that evoke the same feeling that black metal evokes. And I mean, I think it's accomplished in that way. Like it's a very like kind of somber, like dark, ominous atmosphere. And I don't listen to a lot of black metal music, so I guess, you know,
My only other experience is like Deaf Heaven. I don't even know if they count. I don't know if that's like their categorization.
Yeah, especially with like metal music, I feel like there's so many subcategories that that could be completely incorrect. I honestly have no idea. But yeah, I mean, he obviously is not screaming or anything like that, although that would have been cool too. But
no, he does not, although like he does do a voice on Wynn's Dark Poem, pretty ominous voice, like which comes out a little bit more in that performance you sent me to.
That
does feel pretty suited to like being black metal vocals, I guess, even though he's not like really screaming in any capacity. And I don't have experience in this thing. Maybe a lot of black metal vocalists don't scream.
That's true. Yeah, that's a good point, honestly.
Yeah. So my impression is that they do.
Yeah, probably. The lyrics are very metal, though, I think. Just like, you know, decay, the destruction of every day, etc.
And also in that they're kind of like these sort of, I don't know if oblique is the right word, but like very kind of abstract, but like sort of dark and simple concepts in like at the same time.
Wait, sorry, you cut off after the word abstract.
They're like, he presents these very kind of abstract, but also like heavy and dark and very simple concepts at the same time. Which feels very, I don't know, true to that. Although, again, I don't have enough experience with this genre.
Right.
But it does sort of set this album apart from his other albums in a way. That is, like, a little different from how he writes almost anywhere else.
Yeah, I don't really think there's another album in his discography that's kind of fully like this one. Like he definitely kind of will go on to explore the like droney atmospheric side of things with like Clear Moon and Ocean Roar and Sana.
Yeah, he plays with it still, but it's not like this was like a focused effort in a way that those aren't. Not to say that those aren't focused efforts, but just, you know, a focused effort in this style is what I mean.
Right.
Also, I do wanna clarify, I guess, just like as much as he is presenting sort of like a different style for him, it does still feel very Phil Elverum. It doesn't, I don't know, I don't read the lyrics or listen to the songs and be like, this does not sound like Mount Eerie.
Oh,
it still does. It's just different.
Yeah, no, totally. And, you know, he's kind of, I guess, gone into like similar areas sonically with like Mount Eerie parts 6 and 7 and stuff like that. But yeah, I guess it does kind of toe the line between being like, it's still very much a Mount Eerie album, and it's also still very, like, it has a unique spot in his larger discography, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. It feels singular in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Do you own this album physically?
I do not.
So I have the CD.
Okay, cool.
Which is, like, really cheap in his store. Actually, it's, like, $8.
Okay,
you know,
cool.
For a Phil Elverum CD.
Right.
And it's got this really long pamphlet of all the lyrics and, like, these just, like, beautiful pieces of art. Some of them are photographs. Some of them are, like, kind of just watercolor. And they just look burned into the paper in a way I don't totally know how to explain. I don't know. It's really nice. Phil has good album packaging, obviously. This is obviously a thing he spends a lot of time on and thinks a great deal about. I'll just finish this thought. It's kind of like, I don't know. And for this album, it very much adds to the mystique. Like, it does feel almost a little bit more minimal in a way compared to some of his other records. On some of his, I feel like on a lot of his other records, he'll kind of talk about the creation or something in the packaging or just the process in some way, but this says nothing. It's just the artwork and the lyrics and when it was recorded and with who.
Yeah, that is interesting, and it kind of ties back into what you were saying earlier about and I don't want to use the word basic, I guess, like elemental, like it's like,
yeah,
a very elemental album, like both in the things he's talking about and kind of just like the, I guess, sort of the way it's written. It's cool.
I agree.
Also cool that he puts that much effort into like CD packaging in particular. Like, I guess it's sort of common for artists to do cool things with like their vinyl packaging, but I don't really hear a lot about that for CD stuff. Not that I have a lot of CDs to like cross-reference, but you know.
Yeah, no, that is true. A couple pieces of input I would add to that are, you know, Phil kind of does this with everything.
Right.
Every version, I think. And another one is that this was like, you know, this album came out in 2008. It was definitely like, music industry was struggling because of piracy, but it was before real streaming services, you know?
Yeah, that's
so
true.
So I feel like CDs mattered in a way that they kind of feel like they don't now, although I still collect CDs.
Yeah, that's a good point. That is a good point. I might just take a somewhat of a left turn here and just...
Okay.
Can we talk about the song Through the Trees?
Sure.
I don't know, for like, I've listened to Wynn's poem like a good amount throughout the years. I've never as intently as I have been listening to it for the last like month or so. But for some reason, Through the Trees has like always been one of my favorite Mount Eerie songs. Like, even when I wasn't necessarily like into the album as a whole, I've always been super into this song for some reason. I just think it's so gorgeous and like,
right.
It's kind of like, it's like 11 minutes long, and it's kind of just like one synth note like the whole time, but it's like the best synth note.
Yeah.
So it's like probably the sound you hear when you die or something.
Yeah, it's just you watch them play it, and it's like it really is just like two chords, and
yeah,
it's so meditative. It's, I don't know, the only word I wrote about this song in my notes is that it's freaking immense.
It is, yeah.
And I really like that it's as long as it is. It takes its time, and it feels important that it's, you know, that it's like 11 minutes long.
Apparently it was the first song recorded for Wynn's poem. It was recorded, like, I think he said something.
It was
like
recorded on Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
In 2008. Oh, I guess this album was released in 2009. Sorry.
Yeah. But I think that song was recorded in the 2008.
Yes, it was.
So I don't know. I don't know the exact quote. He mentioned something about like being putting an 11-minute song right at the beginning of the album because he just likes to be. I think the phrase he used was compulsively difficult, like that.
Yeah. Yeah, he said he wanted to make it clear from the start that this album was going to be like a little bit more, like, yeah, just difficult, obstructive.
But with that, I feel like, I don't know, because when I was like taking notes with this album, I felt like I really had to like. I was trying to pay close attention and sort of like dissect what he was saying as much as I could, which I don't think is always like possible, but I really like the lyrics to this song just because I feel like they're kind of like I don't know, they're just kind of simple. Like, I like, from up on the hill you can see the lights of town through the trees.
Sorry, the way you said that was really funny. It is, yeah. No, I like that about it too. And it's kind of funny, like, you look at the lyric sheet and Wynn's Dark Poem is literally twice as long as Through the Trees. It occupies twice as much space. But it's just, yeah. Even though there's like, you could say there isn't a lot of content in Through the Trees for it to be like an 11-minute song, but it's just important that it is.
Yeah, well, like you said, it's very meditative.
Yeah.
Like, there's, I'm sorry, I read, like, 5 interviews from around this time, and I don't know when I read what from where, but at some point, he mentioned that he got the idea of, like, the land of dreams from some, like, Buddhist poem of a man sitting up on top of a mountain and kind of watching the town below him and being, like, all those people like living their normal day-to-day lives, like that's the land of dreams, and I'm up here in real life on the mountain.
That feels appropriate in a way. I mean, I think Phil talks a lot about like kind of how like shallow. And this sounds pretentious. I swear it's not coming from a place of pretension. But how shallow American culture and history is, how it's kind of like, you know, half of America just looks the same because we're like all moving from place to place. So it doesn't really matter if it's like an Olive Garden or like a real family-owned restaurant or something. And kind of how, like, I don't know, there's a lot of impermanence here. So that, like, I mean, that's obviously very different from that sort of Buddhist interpretation, but it still feels very appropriate to kind of American culture, and especially the American West, too, because everything is, you know, like, I live on the East Coast, and like, as much as it is like, I don't know, like a history of colonization and stuff, it like there is distinct like history here. Mm-hmm. The colonization is much older here than it is in Washington State, I guess.
Yeah.
In a way, or has deeper roots, and I think like, I don't know. I don't remember where I was going with that. It's just, it's just pertinent. Also kind of pertinent to American capitalism. I don't know. Yeah. It's a good line.
It is, and I kind of like, I feel like with Phil's music specifically, like, I don't know, like, there's definitely not, like, you, I think I've read that thing you were referencing, like, a lot of history in that area, but the fact that, I feel like for Phil and his music, like, there almost kind of is, like, he has probably been in that one spot for like his entire life, and like so much of his music is informed by like that specific area, I guess.
I think in some way he's trying to consciously build this history.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, what's another any other like songs you wanna give a shouts out to here?
Like, you know, I don't know, there are a few, like, Ancient Questions fucking rocks.
Yeah, I love Ancient Questions.
Honestly, Windstark Poem might be, like, one of my favorite Phil openers. Maybe number two after I Want Wind to Blow.
That's a good opinion.
It just, I don't know, there's just something deeply, like, it's just very, like, captivating, I guess, rapturing, I don't know, like, it just comes right out the gate with that loud noise, and it's kind of overwhelming and, like, a little bit too much, and then it takes a step back, and there's those, like, really intense guitar sounds.
Yeah.
And you know, the way Phil sings, and then it just hits you all over again. Like, I don't know, it really works for me, and I think it's, like, I don't know, it tries to make it just, like, makes the album known to you right away, in a way. It's like, announcing itself, and, like, I don't know. It also is just a good song. It's well-written, it's well-structured, I enjoy it a great deal. It's very good.
I think there's a sort of, like, I don't know if the word meta is correct to use here, but I feel like there's almost a meta aspect where it's like, him talking about wind and also like making the sound of wind, like just kind of this existential question, like, why are we here? I don't know. Loud wind sound. It's like, it's kind of like very cathartic.
Yeah, no, totally. Yeah, it's also like, I don't know. You don't, like, I don't know, I feel like if you're feeling bad and you put it on, it's just, like, it just lands, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I don't need to be, like, I don't know, see, I don't always have to listen to, like, a lot of Phil's music is kind of, like, leaning on sort of dark or sad or something. I don't know if he would like to characterize it that way, and oftentimes I wouldn't, like, I will listen to his music whenever, regardless of my mood, you know? But this is just something that kind of lands really well in a specific mood. And, like, I think that's can be true of this whole album. Like, I don't know, many of my listens of this in prep for this podcast have been, like, you know, middle of summer, like midday, you know, in this like little East Coast town, which just feels really like not fitting to the record itself, but it still works. But again, like there were times where I did really feel the disconnect, and it kind of made it hard for me to like want to sit with this and like let this album into my space, because it really demands your attention.
It does, yeah. And I'm sorry, you cut out for a second there again. You're saying something about like listening to it in the middle of the summer.
I was just talking about how it made it difficult to kind of like totally connect with it sometimes. Oh, yeah. or feel like it was like what I wanted to be listening to, because it felt so at odds with what was around me and where I was, you know?
That's definitely true and a fair point. I think I mentioned to you earlier that one of my favorite listens I ever did to this album was like waking up at, I don't even remember why I was up so early, but I was up at 6 a.m. and it was like, I live in the upper Midwest, so there was just like a blizzard happening, and I for some reason thought it would be a good idea to toss a Wind's Poem on, and it was probably the most like, sorry, there's like crazy ass sirens behind me right now.
Yeah, wow.
But
it was probably the most what,
just like fitting, I guess, like atmosphere to listen to that album in. Just kind of like dark, the sun rising, it's cold, it's already evocative of that kind of environment, so listening to it inside of it is kind of like a 4D experience or something.
Yeah, no, I get that. Yeah, I feel like those are some of the best listens of music. I don't know, I like one time I put on Kid A when I was on an airplane and there was really bad turbulence and I was like, am I gonna die? And I don't know, like, I've listened to that album so many times, like, literally hundreds of times, that it doesn't actually do a whole lot to me anymore. I've kind of been taking an extended break on purpose. But, like, in that moment, it was like, I don't know, it just fit the apocalyptic kind of context of my life.
Like, you don't necessarily need to be in a specific environment to enjoy, you know, whatever album, but sometimes you just are in the right place at the right time, and you, like, put on the right thing, and it just hits different.
Yeah. One thing this is totally another left turn, but something I thought about this week that I forgot to mention while we were talking about Wind's Dark Poem is like, this was actually or just the album in general, this was actually a really natural transition for him. Like, I don't know, it is different from his other albums in a lot of ways, and some of the songs could be like, you know, like, I don't have that much trouble imagining Through the Trees or Ancient Questions or Between Two Mysteries on like Clear Moon, Ocean Roar.
Oh yeah.
But like, I don't know, you know, he did well with the black metal style, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, the DNA is there, like.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it was, it feels kind of effortless in a way. The transition.
Yeah, totally. It's different, but I can sort of trace that progression. You know, I can listen to like the song Something on this album, one of many songs called Something, like reminded me a lot of one of the Somethings on The Glow Part 2. And there's like a couple just like distortion things he does that sort of like reminded me of like No Flashlight or like the Mount Eerie album or something. Like, I can kind of see, it's like different, but I can see the through lines. Like, I can understand how he arrived here from what he had been doing before.
Absolutely. It's not unnatural.
Can we talk about Between Two Mysteries?
Sure.
So I just finished watching Twin Peaks: The Return for the first time like 2 weeks ago, or maybe even less than 2 weeks ago. It was like very recently.
Yeah.
So I've been thinking a lot about this because there's actually several, I don't know if there's several, but there's more than one Twin Peaks reference on this album. But it's like easily the most heavy-handed on Between Two Mysteries. Like, it's literally like the intro is just the intro to Laura Palmer's theme.
Yeah.
And like, he literally like references Twin Peaks. So I've been like trying to draw a connection, like, why is he talking about Twin Peaks so much, like, in this album? And I don't know, I have like a couple parallels I was able to draw, if I can go into that.
Yeah, so, yeah, do it.
I mean, like, well, for one, they obviously both, like, quote-unquote take place, I guess, in the Pacific Northwest. Like,
yeah,
there's a show based in Washington, and Phil is from Washington. And I don't think that would matter so much if not for the fact that, like, nature is so intrinsically tied into Phil's music, and, like, he's actually singing about this area geographically.
Yeah.
So, like, when he's singing about nature, you know, he's singing about, like, the same kind of nature that's in Twin Peaks, like fog over dense pine tree cover or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, I think they're, like, atmospherically similar. So I think that's, like, an easy comparison to make.
Yeah, well, nature was a big part of Twin Peaks itself, too. Like,
totally.
Especially in The Return.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, like, there's a whole lot of, like, nature mysticism. And I know that Twin Peaks is a huge influence for Phil. We talked about that on the Glow Part 2 podcast.
Yeah.
Also.
Yeah, because the foghorn sound from that from the Glow Part 2 is supposed to is sort of taken from the Twin Peaks like first couple seasons. But I was trying to, like, and I might be, like, just totally off base here, but I was, like, trying to, like, you know, the, like, Charlie Day Pepe Silvia, like, meme where he's, like, connecting lines of paper on the wall.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I was trying to do that, trying to, like, figure out, like, if there's any thematic similarities between Wynn's poem and Twin Peaks, and I don't know. I guess, like, I mentioned earlier that I feel like a lot of Wynn's poem is sort of trying to tackle these, like, big elemental forces that are kind of out of our control, or just, like, living alongside them. And I sort of get similar vibes from Twin Peaks. Like, these people are just kind of, like, at the whim of this, like, crazy esoteric, like, evil that's in Twin Peaks, and it's kind of, like, out of their control, and they just kind of have to deal with it.
Yeah, I think that's totally appropriate. And then, like, also in Twin Peaks, there's, like, the whole thing where the, like, evil is also, like, kind of embodied in electricity.
Yeah.
and kind of, but not, like, necessarily electricity as specifically, like, controlled or designed by man, but sort of, like, as this, like, force within these everyday objects that we trust that's, like, lingering beneath the surface.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, exactly. That's, like, the exact point I'm trying to make. Yeah. So, I don't know. I was kind of appreciating that, like, it kind of so happened that we got to this album at around the same time that I was, like, really deep into the Twin Peaks lore that I kind of couldn't help but, like, trying to draw direct parallels there.
No, it's totally appropriate, and I'm glad you did, because it's been a little while since I watched The Return. You know, I guess I watched it pretty soon after it aired, so, like, I wasn't really thinking about that, and I wouldn't have drawn that connection. Although, again, this album came out, like, a full decade before The Return.
Before The Return, yeah. There's other Twin Peaks, I wish I wrote them down, but there are a couple. On Ancient Questions, he says, like, a circle of stone surrounded by, like, a pool of black water or something like that. I don't know if just the imagery of that seems exactly like the entrance to the Black Lodge or whatever. I don't know if that's
might be
intentional or not, but
yeah,
that's similar enough that I feel like it probably is a reference, especially on this album.
Yeah.
I wonder
if Phil owns, like, some kind of box set of Twin Peaks, like, because if not, literally, like, it left such an impression on him when it aired in the early 90s that in 2009 he was, like, writing songs about it.
Yeah, right. I mean, I'd have to imagine that he does to some extent, because it's like,
yeah,
this has come up before too. Like, it's probably a pretty important show. I mean, especially since he lives in that area, like.
Yeah,
that's a whole extra layer.
He must have it, because I guess I don't know. I kind of had that thought that it left such an impression on him in the early 90s that he's doing it now, but like yeah. I wasn't even at the time. I was like, box sets are not a thing. They don't put out television. I don't know, but yeah, I'm sure he's watched it since.
I wonder if we'll see Wynn's poem, The Return, now that he's probably seen The Return. Like, I got more to say on the subject. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Between two mysteries, The Return.
But also, just beyond that, Between Two Mysteries is an excellent song. Probably one of my favorite songs on the album, to be honest. I think it's...
No, it's... yeah, I agree. It's grown on me. I think when I first heard it, it threw me off, but I'm really into it now.
Yeah, it's kind of...
It was especially funny because I was like, I'm gonna listen to Phil's black metal album. And, I mean, this was like over a year ago that I'm talking about.
Right.
And I'm like listening to it, and then I'm like, I kind of freaked out and sent my friend a text and was like, Phil covers a Twin Peaks song in the middle of his black metal album.
I know. Yeah, that is kind of funny. You're like, because yeah, my first experience with this was people just calling it like his black metal album, and then I'm like, yeah. Okay, sure, like I'll buy that. And then like the second song is just like an 11 minute like slow drone track, and I'm like, all right.
Yeah, and it was especially like that impression was entrenched for me because I had kind of tried to listen to the album once before, but I didn't make it all the way through Wynn's Dark Poem because it was too heavy for me in that moment. I wasn't like ready for that level of noise, even though I thought I was. So it was like, yeah, it was very, it kind of threw me off. And especially because, like, no disrespect to the Twin Peaks soundtrack. I've grown to find it very compelling. But I remember when I first, like, watched Twin Peaks, the soundtrack struck me as, like, really kitschy and kind of, like, soap opera music. Because, and it is in like a way. That.
Yeah,
yeah, it absolutely is. But it's also very compelling. But yeah, so it was like just funny to hear those kind of really like outdated synth noise in the middle of this, you know,
yeah,
big, grand, heavy, epic.
Yeah, right. It's like you're listening to a black metal album, then all of a sudden it's like. But yeah.
I don't have too much else to say.
I just have a couple things I wanted to say.
Yeah, go for it. I'm happy to listen.
Yeah, just a couple really quick points. One, and we have actually mentioned this. Actually, I think you specifically mentioned this to me, is that it's sort of hilarious that... So, okay, we have the album Lost Wisdom, which contains the song Lost Wisdom. And then...
Oh, yeah.
And then a year later, we get the song Lost Wisdom Part 2 on the album Wynn's Poem.
Yeah,
8 years before we get the album Lost Wisdom Part 2, which contains no song called Lost Wisdom.
10 years.
10 years, and there
a
is real
whole,
Lost
a goddamn decade. What is this, Phil? Yeah. Which is the true Lost Wisdom Part 2?
Well, I'm sort of bummed on Lost Wisdom Part 2. There's that song that's called Real Lost Wisdom, and I sort of looked that it was just called, like, Lost Wisdom Part 3 on the album Lost Wisdom Part 2.
But then should the album be Lost Wisdom Part 3? And there's a conundrum, because the Glow Part 2 is called the Glow Part 2, and there was no the Glow Part 1 album. But then again, there's also the song The Glow Part 2 on the Glow Part 2, that the Glow Part 2 was probably just named after. But I remember distinctly when I first got into the album, I was like, well, where is the Glow Part 1? and you know, this was like 2014 that I like, or 2013 that I first heard about the album, was kind of like starting to show interest. I wouldn't really get into the album for a few years.
Right.
But But like, yeah, it threw me off because I didn't know there was the Glow song, and I didn't know there was a song called The Glow Part 2 on the album.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of confusing layers because according to Phil's own criteria of you can make an album that's a sequel to a song, then I think Lost Wisdom Part 2, it actually should be Lost Wisdom Part 3, and I kind of wish it was now. Phil, if you're listening to this, you should go back and make Lost Wisdom Part 2 actually Lost Wisdom Part 3. It will fit better.
Recall all the physical canon copies and just cross off the 2 and write 3 on it.
Yeah, you don't even need to cross it off. Just like make the little loop on the bottom. Change that 2 into a 3 and we're good to go.
Okay.
That was one thing that I
wanted. Yeah, that was our stupid digression for this episode.
Yep.
I think, well, this is kind of funny. I was watching this little like interview / documentary thing from the sauna period today, and he kind of like, he was talking about Edvard Munch and how like he had these kind of, he had some compositions that he made as a woodblock print and as a painting. And Phil was like, I wonder which was the real version. And then he says, well, maybe he didn't make those distinctions, which I think is inspiring. Yeah. So
that's probably the real answer.
Which I think is fair and right.
Yes. Yeah, that's probably the truth of it. Like we said on the last episode, you know, it's all just a big compost pile.
Yeah. God, that was such a good quote.
I know.
Yeah. And this album very much fits into that too, because it's like, I don't know. I've always thought of this album as kind of a monolith. You know, stone.
Right.
It was not an intentional pun, but then as it was coming out, I was like, that's a pun. But I used to think of this album as a monolith, but it really kind of isn't. Like, I went back and listened to Lost Wisdom, and there are allusions to, like, the kind of concepts and phrases that would be talked about on this album. And mm-hmm. also, like, I don't know. Yeah, it's just, and then there's like Through the Trees Part 2 on Clear Moon. Right. Like it is very much a part of the like living tapestry that is Phil's discography.
Yeah, totally. There's like, there's just a lot of, I guess, similar DNA between this and his other stuff, even if it's not like super, super clear on first listen. Like, it's definitely in there.
Yeah, absolutely.
He definitely likes talking about this stuff. and he loves it a lot.
Thanks for listening, folks.
And, you know, the other thing I was going to mention, actually, before the Lost Wisdom Part 2 thing, and I probably should have mentioned this first, but it's the, and I don't even understand really what it means, but like the dichotomy between stone and wind that shows up on here a lot. Like, he kind of paints them as like two separate, like opposing eternal forces that
are
like kind of a dichotomy. Like, wind is like got a solid form and is like, you know, solid stone, and wind is kind of this like amorphous, like flowing thing, and how they're kind of like at odds with one another. And I don't know like what it means really, but he talks about it in Stone's Ode, which I think is another like really excellent song.
In the interview, he calls stone as the opposite of wind.
Yeah.
And sort of mentions that, you know, some of this kind of explores how stone is being eroded very slowly by wind. And kind of paints these songs as as wind singing about stone and stone singing about wind.
I just think that's so cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a really interesting album. I definitely like... Sorry, I just dropped my Wind's Poem pamphlet onto my laptop mic. It's a really interesting album, and I think, I don't know, I think you can probably go deeper than we've gone on this episode. And yeah. And maybe there would be cause to do that someday. I don't know. It's cool. It's good stuff. That's all. That's all I have to say.
Yeah, no, it's really cool. Just like, I love the concept of it. Like, just, you know, like wind blowing through trees and like, what is it saying? Like if pretending like it's saying words, I think is something that he mentioned in one of those interviews. Like,
yeah.
Pretending
yeah.
wind is whispering to you and like, what is it saying?
Yeah.
Kind of like running with that idea. You could probably take it really deep. Like, I mean, as far as I am aware, Phil reads a lot of like, philosophy, and like there's definitely some like spiritual components to some of this stuff that I really wish I was more well versed in, because I'd really love to kind of like fully dive into that sort of angle. But
yeah,
it's pretty esoteric, and it's like I would need to put like a genuine amount of like effort into it, I feel.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But I don't know, it's still without that knowledge, it's still there's a lot to enjoy. It yeah. feels very cinematic in that
yeah,
way.
Yeah, definitely.
All right.
Yeah.
I think I've said.
I've said my piece.
Yeah.
It's a good size episode. Bigger than yeah. I thought, honestly.
I kind of for some reason anticipated it being like an hour, even though I felt underprepared. It like I don't yeah. know. There's just so much to talk about here.
There really is. It's a very, yeah. very interesting album. One of his more, you know, whatever that means. I think it's one of his more interesting albums.
Which, what's one of his less interesting
well,
albums?
Well, yeah, right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so I believe our next episode is a interlude type episode in which we
yes.
will be discussing following albums. I think it's White Stag, right? That's one of them. Black Wooden Ceiling Opening, I think, is one of them, which I'm extremely excited to talk about. It's one of my favorite
yeah.
like Mount Eerie things. What do you remember what the other ones were?
No, I don't. Song Islands Part 2.
Oh, Song Islands Part
2.
That
might be it.
Yeah, I think so. Well, and then I think the other one we had was just Black Wooden, which is different than Black Wooden Ceiling Opening somehow. I don't know.
Yeah.
We can also split this up.
I have not listened to that one yet.
Yeah. But something like that. Something in that general vicinity will be the next episode.
Yes. Hopefully next week. Right now it feels doable, but Wind's Poem yeah. in a Week also felt doable to me. I'm afraid of making promises. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.
Goodbye.